All right, welcome back to the podcast. And on this episode, I have Dr. Mark Karas, who's joining us, and we're going to talk about his book, The Diabolical Trinity. And let's see, it's Healing Religious Trauma from a Wrathful God, Tormenting Hell, and a Sinful Self. Man, this is a great episode. We don't talk a lot about the theology of hell or a wrathful God, or even original sin. Mostly what we talk about is religious trauma and then how to process it, how to find healing. And so I'm going to link some, I'm going to put his website in the show notes and also the book, so you can click on that and get it. I highly recommend it. If you're just in the beginning stages of processing your religious trauma, you know, he talks about in this book, in the episode, about finding someone who can walk with you through the journey. And I obviously would agree with him and highly recommend that. And if you're going to read the book, if you're not already processing and working through your trauma, then I would encourage you to take it in small bites, like, you know, read a chapter at a time and give yourself space to process each chapter. And then towards the end, like the last section of the book, he does talk about some practical self application that you can do to help yourself to process the emotions that happen with religious trauma. He makes a comment in talking about his testimony. We started off with him sharing his testimony, and again, we're talking about deconstruction in this episode. But he makes a comment of he's been able to deconstruct a lot, except for his experience, like basically what we would call his salvation experience, right? This encounter, the supernatural encounter with the love of God. And he's not the first person I've heard say that. So Science Mike McCarque, I can never pronounce his last name, who wrote Finding God in the Waves, he makes a similar statement. He's like, I've processed and deconstructed so much, but the thing I can't deconstruct is this supernatural experience I have with the love of God. And I found myself saying that to somebody else not too long ago and saying, you know, as I'm processing not just the last 3 years, but the last 18 years of ministry, the thing I cannot deconstruct is that initial encounter I have with God. And I've shared my testimony before. Maybe I'll share more of it in some of the other episodes going forward, but this supernatural encounter with the love of God that was thoroughly transforming. I can't deconstruct it. Like I know this was an experience that I had, and it wasn't my imagination. I didn't make it up. This experience happened. And so I guess I say that because sometimes when we're deconstructing and we're processing stuff, we think that the facts and feelings are separate, and they're not. You know, our knowledge and how we are feeling and the emotions that we're experiencing, they're all interconnected. And so that's why it's this deconstruction and religious trauma, you know, why it's so difficult to process our faith, our religious trauma, because it's intertwined between the facts, what we believe, our experiences, how we're feeling. It's embedded into our psyche. And so it's definitely challenging. It's not going to happen overnight, right? So as you're listening to this episode, I just want to encourage you to begin thinking about who can walk with you through this process. And it doesn't always necessarily have to be a professional, although I think obviously somebody who's educated and trained can help you depending on the depth of your trauma. But I think there's a certain amount that you can process with a friend over a cup of coffee, especially if you get this book and you apply some of the techniques at the end of the book that he talks about, which is offering yourself compassion, you know, self-compassion and the way you live that out. I do want to do one little piece of homework since it's out there now. I have resigned my position as the lead pastor of Devonair, and my last Sunday will be October 15th. So if you're around and you'd like to join us, I would love to say goodbye to you. I don't know the next time that I will preach in front, at least in front of a live studio audience. You know, I may do some devotionals online, but I guess unless somebody invites me to come speak at their church or their event, I don't know when I will ever preach again. As of right now, I am planning on keeping my credentials and I'm not turning them in. So we'll see what happens. I'm not making any decision about my credentials for at least a good 3 to 6 months, and then we'll see from there. But I feel like that's where I'm at. That's what God wants me to do. And that's what I want to do. Well, actually, I would probably just turn them in right now, but I know that would be a rash decision or an impulsive decision. And so I have come to agreement with God that I will wait 3 to 6 months before I make a decision about what to do with that. So that's all I have to say about it. I do have some more episodes coming, and I think you're going to enjoy Dr. Mark Karras, also some of the other ones that are coming. Thank you so much for listening and sharing the podcast. And yes, I do have a new podcast coming that is going to be released soon. You can probably either the first or second week of October. We've been trying to tell better stories about women and clergy in the church, because we really need to tell better stories. Instead of just complaining about it, what if we flood the airwaves with something different? All right, and welcome to the podcast. And thank you so much for coming and joining me on this. And I appreciate it. I know a friend of mine connected me with you, and so I was really glad that you responded and reached out.
Wonderful to be here.
So I'm doing this series on deconstruction. And of course, I want to talk about, we'll get into your book more, but I want to talk about, so if you could just share a little bit like your own religious background, and then maybe a little bit about your deconstruction journey, kind of how you got from there to where you're at now.
It's a long, windy road.
That's okay. So whatever you want to share.
I'll start from the beginning. I was in my mom's womb, I'm just kidding. I won't go that far. I think I'll go, so grew up pretty wild background. It was, I would think a challenging and difficult experience. I think that's just pertinent because of how I got, quote, saved. Mom was a drug addict. She would wind up dying from a drug overdose. Father, mentally ill. 3 out of my 4 uncles, mental illness. My great-grandmother, tracing this back, my great-grandmother died in a mental hospital. And her sister was mentally ill as well. And then my younger brother has paranoid schizophrenia. And he's, he'll be imprisoned for life because of something that happened. Off his meds. So growing up was very challenging. And then my stepdad was in the motorcycle gang called the Pagans. And so it was just a wild, chaotic, dramatic, topsy-turvy kind of upbringing. And so growing up pretty lost, depressed, suicidal tendencies. I was a cutter. And all that to say, I know that I don't want to make this like a Lifetime movie here, but then I did pick up the guitar, which was, I think, a saving grace for me. I started picking it up and playing pretty well, and then got into a band. And that was pretty interesting journey. But my twin brother became a Christian, probably 19-ish, 20 or something like that. And then he would tell me about Jesus. And I'd be like, screw you. I don't want to hear about Jesus. But one thing led to another. And I started having dreams because I was like, I felt like I was running from God. And just really powerful experiences, ultimately culminating into me being alone in this field where the last words BC, I'll never forget it to this day, was, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And if you're real, show yourself to me. And I remember, like, I could deconstruct everything. And I've always tried to deconstruct this narrative, but I just lost it. I cried with an uncontrollable, just overwhelmed by the love of God. And that moment changed the rest of my life, the whole trajectory of the rest of my life. And yeah, no fog machines, no people around me, just me by myself. And it was a very pivotal moment for me. But then I went into Oneness Pentecostalism and got saved in sort of in that church environment. And that's where I think a lot of my religious trauma came from. Very legalistic. Well, I couldn't hang out with people who believe in the Trinity. If women even cut their hair, they would be in danger of hellfire. I remember drinking wine at a wedding and remember telling this visiting preacher of just a story around the wedding and I drank some wine. And he looked at me and said, he just threatened me and said, I was going to hell for such a thing. Like, this is not an exaggeration. And I just felt I felt like God was talking to me. And it definitely had, glucocorticoids and stress hormones rippling through my nervous system, causing a very deep traumatic reaction, which then had an indelible mark as I would continue to move forward in that tradition. Then eventually got out of that and then into Middle of the Road Christian Missionary Alliance. And that was, I would say, a very healing experience, but then started deconstructing a lot. And then eventually getting my Master's in Divinity at Drew University, which was, I would say, a liberal progressive university. So then being in touch with postmodern biblical criticism and post-structuralism and feminist theologies and stuff like that. So, and I was ordained in the Southern Baptist Church. So that was, 2010. And right, so that was just wrestling and deconstructing, and then worked in a Korean Presbyterian church for 4 years. Yeah, so that's a little bit of my background. But then just coming to a point where, I'm sort of post deconstruction, I think, at this point, always tweaking things, but I think there's a real phase, this disorientation phase that some people go through, that it's just like walking on a waterbed rather than solid ground. And, what do I believe about myself and about God and about the church and community and the afterlife and who Jesus really? So I think I'm a little past that, at least with the anxiety that can often accompany that.
Yeah. And we're going to spend most of your time talking about your current book, but I know in your Religious Refugees, you talk about that idea of that disorientation, and like, it kind of come from, I think for most of us, maybe all of us, right? This deconstruction kind of, it seems to come out of nowhere. Like, you didn't go looking for it. It just happens.
Yeah. I know. It's like, who would choose this,
Right.
I mean, maybe I guess there's some people who can intentionally choose to deconstruct and wonder and be curious. But for some of us, it's just like we can't ignore the cognitive dissonance any longer. So it's something coming from within, these cognitive splinters in our mind that cause such an ache that we have to do something, or we're going to lose ourselves or our minds. It just doesn't feel right, feel disjointed, not okay. But it sort of just happens to us. But for many of us, for the better.
It doesn't feel like it when you're going through it, but yeah, for the better.
No, it doesn't. I liken it to sort of moved away from sort of deconstruction and reconstruction, but just to consider it sort of a spiritual metamorphosis. I kind of think of what would a caterpillar, if it had words, what would it say as if it, as it was going through that process to become a butterfly? There would be a lot of curse words and deep agony going through that process, I'm sure.
Yeah, right. Probably. Now, your new book is the Diabolical Trinity and Healing from Religious Trauma.
From the Wrath of God, Tormenting Hell, and the Sinful Self. I know it's a
thank lot. Thank you. I know. It's got a long subtitle, yeah. So I'm like,
I know. Oh,
I should have written the whole title down. How long has that been out?
Less than a year, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. It is 2023. So
yeah.
March, okay. Maybe.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, so still pretty new. Okay, man, this is good stuff. Although I found that I'm like I have to take it chapter at a time because mm-hmm. I feel the anxiety and the trauma. Like I know the word triggered is like so overused right now, but I feel like in my body and my bones is being triggered. And after I get done with the chapter, I'm like, okay, I need to sit and breathe for a little bit and just get mm-hmm. my like anxiety back down.
Great self-care, by the way.
You know, thank good you. Yeah. So it's great. But yeah, it's definitely,
yeah.
Especially if you're still in the throes of it, you've got to take it chunk by chunk or it's too much. But
you're so right. I've heard just to normalize that. I've heard many people contact me and tell me that. So,
well, good. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel better then. At least I'm normative, right?
Yeah.
You say like right in the beginning, which I really liked, you made this comment about information does not always equal or information doesn't equal transformation. Can you like delve into that a little bit and and how that plays into the idea of religious trauma?
Sure, sure. I think so. Let's do this. Well, we're talking about religious trauma, right? So there's different sort of words and phrases around this stuff. But we're not talking about what some call adverse religious experiences. I want to call it consequential, religious experiences that have really a negative impact on us. In other words, some people have experiences that suck, was not cool, didn't appreciate, but they are not necessarily traumatized by it, because it's another buzzword to say I'm traumatized by everything, right? So in some ways it can lose its meaning. But remember, when we're talking about trauma, we're talking about something that it's like a violent sucker punch to our mind and body that leaves us reeling and wondering what the heck just happened. And it's kind of, the key of that is has lasting, adverse experiences that affect our nervous system and makes it go haywire a little bit, causes a sense of disintegration, and it's deeply embedded within the memory network. So it's not something we can just, take five pills of scripture verses and we're healed. So some people have adverse religious experiences, but are not traumatized by them, but some have experiences that are adverse that do have religious trauma, right? And I think I have a like to talk about religious trauma and as a way that sort of also differentiates it from disorientation. So in my other book, I said religious disorientation, growth syndrome. Syndromes are getting out of vogue, and I've gotten some pushback against that. But the point is that some people can feel this disorientation, especially what do I believe? And, I'm not sure I believe this anymore. And it feels like I'm walking on a waterbed rather than solid ground. It's almost like a dark night of the soul-ish kind of experience. But what differentiates a dark night of the soul from religious disorientation is sometimes within religious disorientation, one can come out and not want anything to do with the Christian religion, and some not wanting to have anything to do with God, whereas sometimes my understanding of Dark Night of the Soul, it is something very deep and very powerful and very dark. It can feel very dark, but it usually lends itself to lead others to a deeper relationship with God in some ways. But religious trauma, again, so that's where it's really deeply impacted within our nervous system. So that's why I say there's two aphorisms that I use in my work. Facts will not heal the tracks of the nervous system, and information does not necessitate transformation. So the trauma of hell indoctrination, and when I say hell indoctrination, it is this entanglement. You can't have eternal conscious torment without a wrathful God who created it, and you can't have that kind of hell without evil people to be put there. So it is this entanglement of these doctrines, these interrelated doctrines of a wrathful God tormenting hell and a sinful self. Yeah, these are lodged, especially if it's trauma. This is lodged in the subcortical nervous system. And so since trauma's imprint is on the mind and body, knowledge alone is insufficient to heal it. So it's impossible to talk or lecture a victim out of chronic shame or unrelenting inner criticism, unworthiness, helplessness, insomnia, rumination, flashbacks, nightmares, and disturbing feelings. You can't talk someone out of that, right? That's why even talk therapy is not enough for religious trauma. But effective trauma work really calls for us to travel deep within ourselves, usually with a compassionate other who's skilled in being able to do that. Being able to go past our defenses and enter the tender and vulnerable arena of our bodies and nervous systems to heal this kind of religious trauma.
Wow. It's some of the things you were saying in that chapter about the physiological and psychological effects. I mean, it made me think of the body keeps the score and the idea of that it is, you know, definitely imprinted on us. And towards the end of the book, you talk a little bit about the path to healing. Do you think that everybody who goes through some type of religious trauma, do they have to go through professional counseling? Are there pathways for people? One of the things that it made me think of is a lot of people who are coming out of this kind of, let's say we call it fundamentalism, whatever you want to call it. They've also been programmed to resist counseling and therapy. And so, like, how do you work with all of that when they've got those two competing things that they know that there's trauma there, but then there's also this idea that's embedded in them of, man, you can't trust counselors and therapists.
Yeah. I mean, it is the conundrum. It is people who have caused this kind of harm to us, but yet paradoxically it will be people or a village or an unholy huddle. Of a group, one, two people, three, that really can help bring about healing. So, but I get the thing about counselors. You know, I don't want to reduce it to this is the only way that a person can be healed. But there are people who can do incredible individual work. I don't know. I would just say it's much easier to have a trusted other whom you can journey with, who can be a safe place without judgment, who is skilled to be able to navigate the terrain of the inward being, the psychology, and the understanding of how religious trauma affects, and is skilled in understanding of how one can bring about healing. So I think it's great if people could do that. I also would be understanding that it would be very, very challenging, especially, you know, when I was in the Pentecostal tradition, psychology was looked down upon. I mean, psychology was, I remember reading books on this, where it was of the enemy, the devil. And there were approaches, new thetic counseling, for example, would say, hey, truth and healing can only be found within the biblical text. And I was like, wow. Yeah, thankfully, I don't believe that any longer. But I could understand how people could be a little reticent about going to these people who You know, I would imagine it's gotten easier. I mean, with culture and celebrities and everyone's, yeah, you know, talk to my therapist. I imagine it's a little bit easier for many people. A little older generations, a bit more challenging. I think the younger generations are just like, yeah, I see mine twice a week.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I see mine once a week.
Okay.
I mean, yeah. You know. 2020, if 2020 didn't put us all in counseling, I don't know what will. So,
right.
Indeed. Yeah. Because you made that comment about, you know, and this can't be solved by talk therapy alone, which I could totally relate to that. So what might a path towards healing look like for people who are processing this kind of religious trauma?
I always take a client specificity. It's a phrase that says, I always let my clients lead in that way. Would be very sensitive, and to the chagrin of many clients, I say, I'm not your guru, nor do I want to be. You're coming out of an environment where there was a structure set up with authority figures telling you what to believe, how to believe, and in my tradition, how to dress, what to look like, what music to listen to or not listen to. So I don't want to be another figure who's telling you what to do or how to do it. And just say, listen, you're on your mountaintop, I'm on mine, and maybe I can see things that are, you know, maybe helpful on your journey. The point is, let's collaborate. Now, I do have some thoughts of different ways people can bring about healing, but I want to see what they're interested in, what's has worked for them in the past, what's working for them in the present. But also, yeah, I have an approach, you know, so we talk about some of my approach. But the healing process is an individually tailored approach where I give the utmost respect to a person's autonomy, but just want to be in collaboration. So what that can look like is, I mean, I could say for myself, and I think so many people, you know, in this day and age of social media, it's amazing how people are really helped by folks with platforms, you know, like Pete Enns, you know, like the Religious Trauma Institute, who's doing great work around religious trauma, or the Global Center for Religious Research, headed by Darren Slade, who has whole courses on religious trauma that one can look at. So I think in that way to, and by the way, gosh, some great books are being written about. One is coming out, gosh, is it October? I think it's October, When Religion Hurts by Dr. Laura Anderson. One of the best books I've ever read on religious trauma. And I think hers will be probably the number one book that people pick up on this topic. Hopefully mine is somewhere in the top 10, but I know I've read her book and it's pretty, pretty awesome. So a lot of books are being written on it. There's podcasts, there's courses, but the therapeutic journey is one where people are invited to go deeper with somebody who knows what they're doing and being able to get to the roots of, so some of these other things could be so helpful, but to help somebody go within the subcortical nervous system to work with the traumatic memories themselves. This is where an approach like EMDR might be helpful. For example, in my book, I talk a lot about how one can use the imagination to bring about healing. So for example, let's say I have a memory of being in church and experiencing a very powerful play that, you know, demonstrated, you know, somebody going to hell and there was demons and, you know, Jesus trying to save people. And there, I forget the name of that, that play. But that was very traumatic. Like, oh my gosh. I'm afraid that God's going to send me there. Now there's got to be afraid of demons, you know? So let's go back into that memory and let's have a corrective emotional experience where now we can use our imagination to bring maybe a image of God that's more a loving, a more kind image. Let's, for example, some have used the image of God in the prodigal son, or as I like to call the prodigal father. Prodigal literally means wrathfully wasteful or extravagant. And that's who the father was in his love and compassion, you know, looking for his son. Text says he ran to him. Text says he hugged him. Text says he kissed him. And this dude probably had pig shit on him. Like, that's pretty amazing love. So some people use that image of the father. Some people have problems with the father. So maybe some have changed it to mother. But bringing that into that experience and sort of speak to that experience in a way. I know it sounds hard or complicated through this medium here, but to imagine, okay, here's that event. What would the prodigal father say about that now, knowing what you know now and knowing where the father is trying to take you? And that could be a very healing experience. Some have used Mufasa or an uncle or a grandmother or a wise figure, sometimes even an animal that symbolizes sort of life and love and compassion, to kind of speak truth into that situation, to even imagine holding that kid, let's say it was scared. And so there's a lot of wild and wacky and wonderful things you can do in that way. So that's using, you know, the compassion imagery and tapping into memory reconsolidation. That's just one thing that it comes to mind.
Yeah. You talk about that memory say that again. Memory what?
Memory reconsolidation.
Reconsolidation. Yeah. You talk about that in with chapter 12, I think, 12 and 13. Mm-hmm. Okay. I appreciate that explanation, because I know a little bit about EMDR. And one of the things that always confused me was, so are we like rewriting the memory, but the memory still happened? Like, and so that makes more sense when you say, okay, no, but you're putting another memory, like almost, or another story alongside of it to bring healing that story.
Totally. So in this sense, this includes, in a way, dredging up some of the material associated with the traumatic memory, the imagery or the emotions, the beliefs, the somatic sensations. And it is there in those memories and the neural networks associated with them, located deep within our bodies, where we find the sources of so much of our terror and shame, that then these need processing, revising, and updating. And that's something that we can do, is process them, because some aren't processed, they're disintegrated. So then we process them in a way that sort of can link the left and right hemispheres of the brain. And then we can revise and update them to the point where some of the negative emotional valence of the negative traumatic memories, there's sort of a releasing of it, you know? Mm. So some of the details, of course, remain the same. This isn't Eternal Sunshine on a Spotless Mind. I remember it's a movie with Jim Carrey, where they could, you know, literally erase memories, you know, although that didn't prove so well in the case of true love. But yeah, so we can revise it, you know, we can update it with new material. And so the juxtaposition, or the having the traumatic memory here and the positive, good, loving stuff, igniting that care circuit with the trauma, can literally revise it and update it to some where it's like, oh, I can even talk about that memory, but I don't feel the sheer terror I once felt. And that's because they were processing it, we were integrating it and revising or updating it in some way. You know, dousing it with love is another way of saying it.
Okay, I like that. Yeah, because like in The Blacklist, when Elizabeth Keane has her memories erased, like, we're not talking about that. Like, we're not doing sci-fi stuff here.
Right.
Now, can you talk a little bit more about EMDR? Like, I'm familiar with it, but I don't know if my audience knows really what that is.
Yeah. Well, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And yeah, anyone could look it up. Hundreds of different research articles on it at this point. I don't go too much into it in the book, but what I do take with EMDR is it really is dealing with the traumatic memories in a way that helps sort of reprocess them, right? And so to update and revise them, but it has a particular protocol. What I have taken from it is they've, part of the, you know, the protocol is the bilateral stimulation. So in the earlier days, they would just do the eye movements. And then while someone was doing that, then they can sort of, you know, whatever comes up, they were sort of almost, what is that? It's almost the, what is that word I want to call? Not sort of brainstorming, but just allowing the mind to just come up with whatever comes up without judgment. And as they're doing bilateral stimulation. Now we, you know, people do bilateral stimulation in the form of butterfly hugs. So here's would be an example. I have a traumatic memory, and this is really quick, simple version. The therapist says, you know, you set it up. Of course, you will want to resource them with positive resources, want to make sure they're okay and don't get overwhelmed to the point they come incapacitated in some way emotionally. But they could talk about the memory as they're doing this, for example, and whatever comes up without filtering. And as a person can do that, they're just allowing all this material. Sometimes they start from the beginning of the memory to the end of it, whatever comes up. See, part of the problem is we stuff things down. And sometimes things are so overwhelming for our nervous systems, we can't go there. It would literally crush us. Some people can even go into a psychotic state. Like defense mechanisms are really, really helpful for a really good reason. And of course, what is adaptive in one context can be maladaptive when you hold on to these defenses for too long. But so there's a way as one person is doing that. And so just the process, whatever comes up. And sometimes, again, we can, and if some person gets stuck in that memory, and I don't know, I'm in that memory and everything feels dark and I feel really alone. And then a therapist might say, who can come in that moment that could be most helpful to you right now? My Aunt Mary. Okay, let's bring Aunt Mary into this picture and let's just go with that. Let's bring Aunt Mary, go back inside and just go with that. And they start again. I know it's kind of weird stuff, but again, the point is it's just about really processing as opposed to just talk therapy. Yeah, just talk about it. There's no going into the body. There's no going into experience. And so people could get stuck doing this stuff for years or just same old, just talk about stuff. The problem with that is it can create the grooves even more deeply within neuronal connections. Because when you talk about it, you're just basically bringing the memory back up, but there's really no juxtaposition of any corrective emotional experience. And so it just keeps rehashing. Anyway, that's a really, there's just so much to talk about there. But I do talk about other really healing mechanisms and principles and practices. For example, self-compassion work. That's just huge in my work. It is the submersive middle finger to an angry, wrathful God who's constantly wanting to judge you, and a community who's being God's mouthpiece and constantly rejecting you and calling you a heretic. To then be able to say, how can I love myself? How can I be kind to myself in the midst of my suffering? That's powerful. And to talk about principles and practices to be compassionate to myself as I would a dear friend who is suffering. I wouldn't judge them or ridicule them or speak negatively or harshly. Well, how can we learn to do that for ourselves? It's really powerful to do self-compassion work.
Yeah. I can definitely see how that would be very beneficial. I know in not my denomination is not the only one that has this idea of sanctification, self-sacrifice, surrendering everything, right? And so I think part of what I hear a lot from people is not being able to offer compassion to themselves because they've been programmed with the sense of, no, you surrender everything. You should empty yourself of everything. You should they can't even offer themselves self-compassion because it goes against like what's being taught, right? Like, I don't see that in Jesus. Like, Jesus is like, there's a crowd that wants to see you. And he's like, too bad, I'm going want to have some me time, you know, like, so yeah, I appreciate that. It's, so is there something you can, like, how can we walk people through some of that idea of, yes, you have permission to offer yourself compassion, you know, I guess like trying to correct that idea that they're being.
Yeah, hugged. Totally. I think there's a two pronged approach of one is a bit more rational, you know, sort of this might get into narrative therapy where we talk about where did you learn this, you know, and talking about doctrine and talking about different ideas and, you know, talking about Jesus and like, oh, right. We're taught that my heart is deceitfully wicked. There's nothing good that's within us. The flesh is wicked. The self is bad. Like, yeah, we were taught that how many, I know in my tradition, constantly heard that. But this is kind of interesting. Can you tell me what the greatest commandment is? Yeah, love God, love your neighbor as your, what? I've never heard in all my life one sermon of the three principles of how to love myself. But that's in the greatest commandment. What in the world is going on here? So it's fascinating. You know, it's embedded within the greatest commandment itself. Now, I understand in that tradition, maybe it had different nuances of what we might consider self-compassion, self-love today, but it's still in there. And my brothers and sisters and everyone in between in the East, they are connoisseurs of self-kindness, self-compassion, self-love, loving kindness. So I think part of it is, you know, deconstructing the narratives that were around that. You know, some of it is the biblical text and helping to give different context to some of the things, but it's also the practice, you know, just to go inside, you know, or just to imagine, you know, if your nephews, because some people don't have children, but if your nephew or your niece was sitting on that couch, struggling with something very similarly to you, how would you respond to them? What would your tone be like? What would the words be like? What would your nonverbals be like? What would your posture, right? Be like, well, I wouldn't judge them. I'd love, well, is there any way that you could do that for yourself, right? Why are you exempt here, right? Why should we love others in this way, but so despise or hate the self that we can't offer that to ourselves? And then we'll try it. You know, we'll try, listen, I want you to put your hand on your heart and let's repeat these words and see what it feels like. And this gets into Kristen Neff's work too. The three-pronged understanding of self-compassion is common humanity. So mindfulness, common humanity, and self-kindness. So because there's also the opposite. So mindfulness is sort of just being fused, right? My mind is telling me I'm horrible, I'm a piece of garbage, and I just believe what my mind says, as opposed to, no, my mind is telling me that I'm a piece of garbage and I'm going to hell, as opposed to, yeah, I'm just fused with, like, it just says it, so I believe it. Like, there's a difference there. And that's another, I always want to do things experientially. So try to say, if someone is working through hell trauma, God hates me. I'm going to hell and I'm going to be tortured for eternity. See how that feels. Oh God, I've been terrible. Okay. Try this. My mind is telling me that God hates me and that I'm going to, there's something different there. It creates a little distance, right? So that's the one piece of like, this is what self-compassion is according to her work, a three-pronged approach. And then common humanity is, oh, I'm not the only one suffering with this, you know, as opposed to I am the only, no one understands, no one knows. And then the last piece is self-kindness as opposed to self-judgment. So the point is, let's try it, put your hand on your heart. This is a moment of suffering, mindfulness. There's other people who are suffering just like me with religious trauma, common humanity. May I know that I will get through this. I have people who care about me, and I will heal from this religious trauma, self-kindness, right? A simple practice to include those components. So anyway, the point is, how can we experience this, not just talk about self-compassion?
Wow. Experience is huge. I have lay people and clergy who listen to the podcast, but a big chunk of them are clergy, and many of them are starting that process of deconstruction, and they're doubting and they're asking questions, especially in light of the last 3 years. And of course, I think it was your book. I can't remember which one, but I think it was the Diabolical Trinity one, where you talk about the idea of, you know, how hard it is when your livelihood depends on you staying true to what you've been taught, right? So I guess maybe advice for people who are wrestling with that element of it, of I am doubting, there's stuff that I know is not right, that I'm questioning. How do I balance this idea of my whole livelihood depends on this? I've given my whole life over to this, right? Like, we've done all this schooling, we've, you know, gone through the ordination process, we, you know, all of this, and you know, but I need to, for my own well-being, mental well-being, I need to process this.
I mean, I have such compassion for pastors. I see a lot of them. A lot of pastors contact me. They don't know who to talk to, you know. Can't talk to other pastors sometimes, especially if in particular denominations. And if this came out to elders, you know, they would be, you know, kicked out. It's, and some do get kicked out. It's just so tragic. There's such a deep sense of aloneness and fear. What do you do? You know, you've been went to seminary, you learned all this material. Not only that, but the grief, just even imagining that is like insomnia. I can't even sleep at night just thinking about this. And then there's another piece of, I don't want my family to suffer. I've had some pastors say, what if I lead my wife to hell? You know, what if my kids, you know, what if this crashes their own faith? And it's, so there's so many different fears and insecurities and grief and shame and pain. And so much compassion for pastors. You know, I'm a realist. It is hard. You know, I'm not a quick fix kind of guy. It's such a long, hard process to, in the vernacular, deconstruction and reconstruction, spiritual metamorphosis, whatever you want to call it, especially for pastors, which is why they need somebody, which is why they need I don't care if it's a life coach, counselor, other pastor who's been there, done that, got the t-shirt. They need community. They need someone they can be fully congruent with without fear of reprisal or judgment. So that's just a huge step. It makes me so sad because people don't understand the plight of the pastor in this way. It's like, it literally is cataclysmic. Like, what do you do? You work in Walmart? How do you even support your family? What do you do about the God thing? I mean, so many, my heart. So I don't have an easy answer, but I know undoing the aloneness, being with somebody who can help navigate and walk you through this stuff as a pastor, it's just so paramount. Yeah, they cannot do it alone. So that's what comes to mind for me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. At the end of the day, we still need community. So.
Yeah. Even you know, the monks have other monks, and who would that?
Right?
Tom Hanks had Willis. What was his name? Willis? No. What was the ball from the?
Oh Tom yeah, Hanks? Wilson.
Castaway Wilson. There you go. There you go. He had Wilson. Yeah.
I'm gonna have to buy a bunch of Wilson volleyballs and send them to pastors.
Well, I hope they can have alternatives than balls to help them on the journey.
Right? Yeah.
But if worse comes to worse. Yeah.
So any last words of advice or encouragement that you want to, obviously I will put that in the show notes where they can find your book. I don't know if there's, and you have a website too, so I'll make sure I link the website. But any last words of encouragement or advice that you want to leave?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, probably just more of the same. You know, if somebody is really struggling through their doubts, incessant questions and wanderings and wonderings, community is paramount, even if it's one person. find somebody, gosh, to talk to about this. Sometimes, you know, there are groups. A lot of my therapist friends have groups that people can be part of as well. There'll be the occasional pastoral group too, where people can have that safe place to work through this stuff with other pastors. But I just want to normalize it. You know, I don't even want to fix it. You know, it's just like, this sucks. This is hard. I'm sorry that you're going through this. I also have compassion. I mean, no one's signing up for this. And many of the people and pastors that taught us this stuff, some are narcissists, but many are well-meaning pastors who are trying to, you know, follow the biblical text. And they're just repeating what was repeated to them for generations. So I have compassion for them too. And it's just a long process of being honest, being truthful, and committing to a path. One, we need to choose to deal. Then we need to choose to feel. And then we need to choose to reveal so that we can heal. And not everyone signs up for that process, mm-hmm. but it's one could be bitter or become better. And there is a path of betterment. And yeah, reach out. You're not alone.
Definitely. Yeah. That's good. That's good advice.